we're trying to do the best that we can from a due diligence point of view, but at the same time, not hindered businesses either.
A new policy allows Juneau marijuana producers to move product through the airport. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, to prepare for a notorious spot on the Iditarod Trail, some mushers armor up.
It's like the old bold pilot thing. There's old pilots and there's bold pilots, but there's no old bold pilot. Same for mushers.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday, you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with Nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV.
The nominee to be the next head of the U.S. Geological Survey says he's inclined to share sensitive data with his higher-ups at the Interior Department if they ask to see it.
Based on my experience in my other occupations up to this point, I always felt like I had a responsibility to deliver information to my leadership, particularly if it had an impact on how the leadership is supposed to respond to it, particularly in something that might indeed be sensitive.
James Riley is a geologist and a former astronaut. The question of whether political leaders at the Interior Department are allowed to have an advanced peek at USGS data erupted over the winter. USGS is an independent research arm within the Interior, but USGS scientists guard their work from even the appearance of political influence. Their practice has been to let the bosses at Interior see their data only when it's available to the public. A USGS scientist resigned late last year, and another retired early to protest the Deputy Interior Secretary's demands that they turn over data about the oil potential in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, before it was published. Riley says he doesn't have all the details of the case. He says he'd resist attempts to alter reports.
If somebody were to come to me and say, "I want you to change this because it's the politically right thing to do," I would politely decline.
Riley says he would expect his leaders to keep a close hold on confidential information. He also allowed there might be exceptions to his willingness to deliver data to his higher-ups.
Somebody could come to me and tell me that they were in a position where they were uncomfortable with that, then we would, of course, deal with that specific example at the time and hopefully wouldn't get into the situation that occurred here.
Riley testified before the U.S. Senate Energy Committee. Panel Chair Lisa Murkowski said she hopes the Senate quickly confirms him. Riley also has Democratic support. A spokeswoman for the Interior Department said in an email last month, the Interior Secretary and his deputy have legal authority to see any scientific data or draft reports produced at Interior. A top state regulator is asking lawmakers to make sure oil companies pay to clean up old oil wells, even after the wells are sold to a different company. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has the story.
Kathy Forrester of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission testified before the Senate Resources Committee on Monday. Forrester warned that if a big oil field like Prudhoe Bay is sold to a smaller company that goes bankrupt and can't pay for cleanup, it could cost the state billions of dollars. Forrester says the state currently has a $200,000 bond to cover the cost of plugging and abandoning all the wells at Prudhoe Bay.
For $200,000, we couldn't even pay for the engineering study that would give us the estimate of what the true cost is to plug all of those wells. So we're in a bad situation on having adequate bonding for our wells, and we're working it.
Forrester says her agency has the authority to increase bond amounts. But Forrester argues the legislature should also act, updating the law so former operators can be required to pay to clean up abandoned oil wells.
Don't we want to have the ability to go back on BP, Exxon, and Conoco and say, you guys made a boatload of money off of this, and you drilled these wells, now get back up here and clean them up. We need you guys to take care of that.
According to Forrester, two other states, California and Kansas, have passed similar laws. Alaska Oil and Gas Association President Kara Moriarty says her group wants to see legislation before it forms a position on Forrester's proposal. But Moriarty says her group is generally wary of additional regulations.
I would just be cautious of anything that seems to put another hurdle on companies either coming to Alaska or being interested in investing in Alaska.
Moriarty referred to the issue of future well abandonments as, quote, a potential problem that may not exist, unquote. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
A change in policy by Juneau Police means licensed marijuana producers should now be able to fly their product out of Juneau on commercial airlines. Until recently, commercial cannabis was allowed to fly in, but not out, of Juneau International Airport. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
In an industrial area of the Mendenhall Valley, a red, nondescript metal building houses THC Alaska. Manager Lacey Wilcox opens the door to a warehouse with blindingly bright grow lights.
So here we are in the flower room. This is where our plants will go into a 12 and 12 light cycle so that they can finish their blooming process and create big, beautiful, sticky buds.
Marijuana and its concentrates are produced here for Juneau's retailers, but they also have customers in other parts of Alaska. Juneau's geography means flying or crossing water to get it there, which involves federal legal jurisdiction. Juneau's pot producers have been turned away from boarding commercial flights. It's not clear exactly what the hang-up was. There were different explanations, most coming back to the tension between state and federal marijuana laws. But that's all supposed to change. All four of Juneau's licensed cultivators got a letter in the mail on Valentine's Day on Juneau Police Department letterhead. THC Alaska co-owner Ben Wilcox reads from his copy.
And as to whom it may concern, this letter is to advise of a procedural change the Juneau Police Department will be making when dealing with legally licensed marijuana being transported via the Juneau International Airport.
The letter CCs the U.S. Attorney's Office and TSA. Juneau Police Deputy Chief David Campbell says it's an evolving industry.
You know, we're trying to do the best that we can from a due diligence point of view to make sure that we, you know, comply with what we're supposed to comply with, make sure people have the proper documentation, but, you know, at the same time, not hinder businesses either. So we're just trying to find that balance.
Ben Wilcox is taking the police at their word. He's packed a carry-on plus a personal item for a Wednesday morning flight.
Between these two bags, I can easily get 15 pounds of trim, or about 900 units of concentrates.
Since commercial pot was legalized, product has flown in to Juneau's airport. And the Wilcoxes have flown product out of other airports in Alaska. Lacey Wilcox also sits on the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association's board. She says the Juneau exception was puzzling for everyone in the industry.
It was hard for us to understand why Juneau was so different and all airports were freely coming and going and Juneau wasn't. We knew that it was a city-run airport versus a state-run airport. But beyond that, we really couldn't understand why the requirements would be different from one to the other when we're talking about in-state commerce.
There has been a lot going on behind the scenes. Meetings between the marijuana industry and Juneau police and city officials have been ongoing. She says in the beginning, it was awkward.
It's always uncomfortable to go into the police department and say, I'm a legal drug seller, you know, and you've always looked at me one way, and I'm hoping you'll look at me a different way starting today, and how can we help you do that? And so it took a lot of people some guts to go and have that conversation.
Ben Wilcox has his round-trip ticket in hand and alarm set for an early wake-up.
Now we're going to give it a shot and turn hopefully 3 or 4 day trips into 1 day trips.
That's assuming the weather cooperates. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
The Aleutians East Borough plans to join the legal battle over a land exchange that would allow construction of a controversial road between King Cove and Cold Bay. In January, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke signed a land exchange agreement with the King Cove Corporation that would allow for a road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Assembly members voted unanimously last week to intervene on the side of the federal government in the lawsuit environmental groups brought against the Interior Department to stop the road. The borough approved spending more than $60,000 to hire a law firm to help them join the case. That money will also help four other local entities, the King Cove Corporation, the City of King Cove, the Anakdale Tribe, and the Native Village of Belkovsky. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Alaska Railroad's first black conductor celebrates an unprecedented 50 years with the company.
I've been number one so long, that, like I said, I've even forgotten how long I've been number one.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Last year's Iditarod champion is leading this year's race. Mitch Seavey left the Nikolai checkpoint a little before 1 p.m. this afternoon. He was followed closely by Yor Lethsup Olsom, Ryan Reddington, Nicholas Petit, and Aaron Burmeister. The leaders are expected into McGrath later this evening. Another Iditarod legend is out of the race. Willow musher Didi Johnro has scratched from the 2018 Iditarod. The fan favorite with her pink clothes, sled bag, and dog booties was running her 36th Iditarod and had said this one would be her last. Johnro pulled out at the Rainy Pass checkpoint a little after 11 a.m. today. According to a statement from the Iditarod, Johnro made the decision to scratch for, quote, personal health reasons and concern for taking care of her dog team, which is her number one priority. Johnro competed in the 2003 Iditarod not long after chemotherapy for breast cancer. She and her husband Mike lost their home in the 2015 Sockeye fire. In the Iditarod, Johnro's record includes 16 top 10 showings, including a string of them from 1988 to 1998, and two second place finishes. This morning, most of the Iditarod mushers were crossing one of the most dangerous sections of the trail. The route winds up the wooded hillsides of the Happy River steppes toward the jagged mountains ringing frozen Puntilla Lake, and then head through a narrow canyon toward the zigzagging Dalzell Gorge. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, even years later, the terrible 2014 conditions along that stretch has left a lasting impression on mushers, one that they now bring specialty gear for.
Jim Lanier did not become a 77-year-old musher by fooling around.
Well, the thing is, it's a contact sport.
Standing in the sunshine with his team of ghostly white huskies at the Finger Lake checkpoint, Lanier is wearing what looks like a black high-tech exoskeleton.
It's sort of full-body armor. Neck to crotch, I'm covered. And elbows and knees. I got it there, too.
The gear is technically for mountain bike racing, an upgrade from the hockey pads Lanier has worn in past years. The protective equipment is specifically for the 100 miles of trail through the Alaska Range, on past Roan and into Nikolai. Lanier has broken enough bones in the course of his mushing career to dress with precaution in mind.
It's like the old bold pilot thing. There's old pilots and there's bold pilots, but there's no old bold pilot. Same for mushers.
Lanier's hardly alone in treating this section of trail with extra reverence. One checkpoint ahead at Rainy Pass, Scott Jensen reaches into a drop bag shipped specifically for this particular part of the trail and pulls out a chest protector meant for high-speed snow machining.
It's all hard-sided, keep me from breaking some ribs. And then I got my boy's snowboarding helmet. I mean, better safe than sorry. I don't want to hit my head and get knocked out of the race.
In the 2014 race, when the downhill gorge was so icy there was no way to control dog teams as they charged over rocks and tree stumps, Jensen made it down relatively unscathed. But his luck ran out going through the Buffalo Tunnels on the way to Roan.
I crashed and got a concussion. About 4 hours later, I broke through some ice, ran back to my sled, slipped on the ice, and broke my foot.
Jensen scratched that year, and the experience seriously affected him. He had bad anxiety in the 2 weeks before this year's race, stuck in thoughts about the most brutal parts of the trail. That's similar for Kelly Maxner, who in 2014 led the pack down the gorge and was the first to make it to Roan.
It is a little bit of PTSD from that. You know, I think anytime you're fearing for your life or anything like that, which I think that at that point in time I actually was, because that was pretty nerve-wracking through there that year.
Maxner did not pack extra protective gear this time around, largely because the snow conditions are vastly better, and because mushers were assured they would not face that degree of hazard again. An outcry after the 2014 race prompted the Iditarod to take extra precautions determining if areas of the trail were suitably safe. From overhead, the thin ribbon of trail snaking through the gorge had plenty of snow, but also plenty of open water, which could make for a soggy run out of the mountains. From Finger Lake and Rainy Pass on the Iditarod Trail, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
It's one of the snowiest years in recent memory along what has been a notoriously bare stretch of the Iditarod Trail. For the last few years of races, low snow and bald, icy trail conditions have made for a perilous run down the Dalzell Gorge through Roan and across the Farwell Burn on the way to the village of Nikolai. But this year, checker Damian Dennis says that hasn't been a problem.
We just got dumped on here within the last week.
The conditions made for a less eventful run for many of the first mushers into Nikolai Tuesday morning. Mitch Seavey said it was the most snow he'd ever seen in the area during an Iditarod. Wade Mars had to stand on the seat of his sled to keep his boots dry going through some overflow, but was otherwise unperturbed. Ryan Reddington was the first musher into Nikolai and says the hardest part for his team was punching through a trail that was just barely there.
A little soft. Breaking trail, wind blowing.
After the Roan checkpoint, the trail narrows through the buffalo tunnels, so called because a local bison herd has been known to travel through the area. Then the land opens up along the Farwell Burn before eventually meeting the top of the Kuskokwim River. Your Olsom says the 70-odd mile stretch into Nikolai had some unpleasant soft patches and overflow that dampened dog booties, but overall he's grateful for the snow cover.
I mean, the whole gorge, the burns, I've never ever seen snow in the burns before, but this year we had snow. So that was pretty nice.
Olsom had all 16 of his dogs still on the line when he pulled in, looking energized and alert. All the other mushers who arrived early into Nikolai had big teams as well. That power will be important for the slog ahead. With deeper, windswept snow, dog teams have to work more than they would have on a hard-packed, faster trail. Weather over the area and up toward checkpoints like McGrath, Takotna, and Ophir may mean slower, more draining runs in the stretch ahead.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The University of Alaska Anchorage is investing in Alaska by equipping students with the knowledge and tools for academic success. These students will go on to be the doctors, nurses, teachers, engineers, and artists of Alaska who shape the future of the state by bringing new solutions, inventions, and ideas to the table. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More information at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
Harry Ross never imagined he'd be conducting trains, but in 1968, he became the first black conductor for the Alaska Railroad. Today marks Ross's 50th anniversary with the company, a milestone never reached by any other trainmen. Alaska Public Media's Victoria Peterson has this profile.
Harry Ross started moving trains when he was 21. 50 years later, he's still transporting passengers and freight by rail across the state.
I do not believe there has ever been nobody as foolish as I.
It wasn't a job Ross expected to get, and it wasn't the job he originally hoped for. After graduating from East High School in 1964, Ross worked as a mess attendant at Elmendorf Air Force Base. His mom wanted more for him and sent him to college in San Francisco. After dropping out of school, Ross applied for two jobs, one with Western Airlines, now Delta, and one with the Alaska Railroad.
I didn't have the education to be a brakeman or a trainman, period. I never thought about the railroad my whole life growing up and through high school. I never thought about being working at the railroad in no way, shape, or form.
Ross has been the number one conductor at the Alaska Railroad for over half of his career.
I've been number one so long, like I said, I've even forgotten how long I've been number one.
Having the highest seniority among conductors comes with some perks. He says he gets the first pick of routes and vacation time.
It's a joy. Everybody salutes you like, hey, number one. They don't call you Harry Ross. They say, hey, number one, you know, and that's pretty interesting and it's fun.
The workplace wasn't always so friendly towards Ross. As the first minority trainman hired by the company, Ross says he was met with opposition almost immediately.
I had a lot of people that I worked with that did not want to work with me, only because of the color of my skin. And, of course, that didn't bother me because I've always been a people person. And I figured one way or another I was going to win them over. And one by one, I did. And there are some that, of course, I didn't. And you're just not going to change those people. That's just the way they are.
In his time at the railroad, Ross has seen the company go from federally owned to state owned. He says safety is a higher priority and the trains are more heavily regulated. Ross says the best change the railroad implemented in his 50 years is the Alaska Railroad Tour Guide Program. The program began in 1980 and is open to high school juniors and seniors enrolled in the Anchorage School District.
Well, basically, it gives the kids a chance to get into the job market. And I enjoy working with these kids because everybody's energetic and they really love what they're doing.
John Mobley was a tour guide in 2009 and worked at the railroad in multiple positions, including conductor, until 2017. Mobley says after years of mentoring under Ross, they're like family now.
Taught me a lot when I was in the tour guide program, just as a tour guide, and he taught me even more when I climbed the ladder and finally became a conductor. He taught me a ton as well. So he's just been very crucial to my time at the railroad.
Ross says he plans to retire at the end of the summer.
I don't know how it's going to feel when it's time to say goodbye, but I know it's eventually going to come. I don't want to die on the job. I want to enjoy some of my life that I have left. But I can say I am going to truly miss what I've been doing for the last 50 years.
Ross says he plans on writing a memoir about his life growing up in Alaska and his time working on the railroad. In Anchorage, I'm Victoria Peterson.
Many people in Northwest Alaska grew up eating traditional foods like caribou, seal, and sheefish. But as they aged and moved into long-term care facilities, those foods were no longer regularly available to them because of federal food safety regulations. A team in Kotzebue is changing that. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman learned more for the Solutions Desk.
Welcome to the Sigloq. Yeah, modern-day Sigloq.
Sigloq is a Nupiaq for ice cellar, but this modern one is more than a storage space cut into the permafrost. Cyrus Harris stands in a sterile-looking room with stainless steel sinks and a commercial-grade bandsaw. He's helping fill plastic bags with caribou T-bone steaks, then vacuum sealing them for long-term storage.
What we have more abundance of is this caribou. It's our beef, but it's a wild game.
What he's doing, processing and storing wild foods to give to elders, is nothing new. It's an intrinsic part of Inupiat values, like sharing, respect for elders, and hard work. It's where he's doing it and how that matters.
Of course, up here I got some trout, Arctic char, salmon, or whatever you want to call it. I got it up here.
The Sigloq is a small, white, old wood shop that was converted into a meat processing and cold storage facility in 2015 by the Manilik Association, which provides healthcare and other services in the Northwest Arctic region. It was built to solve a very specific problem. Federal laws prohibited them from serving traditional foods like caribou and moose to elders in the long-term care facility. The laws were put in place to make sure the meat wouldn't make anyone sick. But Cyrus, who grew up in the region and runs the Sigloq and other programs, says denying the elders consistent access to foods they grew up with wasn't healthy.
There's a big gap missing somewhere along the line. If I were at a setting and the foods that I was raised with, I was restricted from eating. Something's not adding up there.
Donating traditional foods to schools and other organizations has been legal for years, according to state law. But you couldn't give them to federally licensed facilities, like long-term care centers. Then, in 2014, the federal government legalized it too, sort of. There aren't federal food safety laws for things like moose or whale, so the meat couldn't be certified. After months of back and forth, a team from Manilok, including Environmental Health Manager Chris Dankmeyer, sat down with the state and the feds and figured out legal workarounds. Yeah, they just talked it through.
They just want to see the steps that are taken to make sure things are safe for the people that are going to be eating it. So, you know, it wasn't very difficult. Once we knew, well, it's the state code, and let's get them on board with what we're trying to do, and they were very supportive of all that. It wasn't very difficult.
And that was that. It helped pave the way for traditional food programs at healthcare facilities around the state, including Nome, Anchorage, and now Southeast Alaska. Some accept food straight into the kitchen. Others send meats to licensed butchering facilities. In Kotzebue, Cyrus runs the only processing facility of its kind in the state. He inspects every animal that is brought in and asks questions about how it was harvested, though he and his hunting partners bring in most of the donations. The animals are chopped up into usable pieces, vacuum-packed, and neatly labeled. Back in the freezer at the Seegluck, Brittany Anderson, who works with the CDC and helps Cyrus, explains the labels are another necessary step to make sure the elders are cared for.
If it is a foodborne outbreak, we can contain it without it getting worse and worse and worse.
Which is at least not going to happen, you know, because all our stuff is good, but we're following through with what we could to be along with the regulatory.
Best practices, which we already do, but this is us documenting it.
And because they're following the best practices, elders like Richard Hensley have access to the foods they've grown up with. He laughs easily as he rolls around in his wheelchair, showing off his fishing hooks, always ready to go ice fishing. He says he can keep doing that because of one thing.
Well, if we didn't have no traditional food, I don't know how I'd be getting around.
He says without the traditional foods and Cyrus, he wouldn't be alive. From the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Harbaugh, Victoria Peterson, and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Kotzebue, and Zachariah Hughes in Rainy Pass. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. Find out how you can include a gift to your public radio station through estate planning. Ask your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.